I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. One of our guests, Robert Creeley's short and inviting poem, ends like this. This is a poem which tells the story, which is the story. I don't know, I get lost. If only they would stand still and let me. Are you happy, sad, not happy? Please come. This is a poem for everyone. Connection listeners, there's an invitation here for all of us, and let's take him at his word. Robert Creeley writes short poems in the American vernacular, and there's not a lot of unnecessary distance about the man or his work. You could say he's a poet of loneliness, but you could just as well say that he's a poet of family and of domestic places. Just as important, he's a poet of many cross collaborations with painters and with jazz musicians. He speaks of making poems the way the artist Paul Klee spoke of taking a line for a walk. You never forget that Robert Creeley grew up artistically in the world being remade in the 40s and 50s by painters like Jackson Pollock and musicians like Charlie Parker. Though there are older roots that keep Robert Creeley, that he keeps growing into in the old Yankee farms west of Boston. We're talking this hour with the American poet Robert Creeley and what his friend Tom Clark calls the genius of the American commonplace. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, finally, Robert Creeley.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
You've had a lot of your friends, a lot of your collaborators, and a lot of people who said you've got to have Robert Creeley on the program.
My company. Terrific.
I wish you'd begin by just giving us the sound of your own words in your own voice from any of these wonderful poems.
Here's one, an oldie but goldie, called Oh No. If you wander far enough, you will come to it. And when you get there, they will give you a place to sit for yourself only in a nice chair. And all your friends will be there with smiles on their faces. And they will likewise all have places. Old friend Joel Oppenheimer, dear fellow poet, said this would make me an honorary Jew, this poem, which I think...
Now you have to explain that, but why do you call it Oh No?
Well, I don't want to go to that place. That place is either some sort of terrifyingly imagined... well, it's like almost like a rest home. You all sort of sit in chairs put out so you can see the sun or something. Or
musical chairs without the music.
It's a heaven that doesn't seem to be very attractive. That sense of they will likewise all have places. I think that's an early poem indeed, but it's my pleasure in the sense I like the with smiles on their faces and they will likewise all have places. That I love that kind of crunky, easy, unworked for sense of rhyme and rhythm. So I really feel at home with those.
Hmm. Read us another. Read us 10 others.
Uh-huh. Not so easy. Let's see what's. I had notes. Here's one, curiously, it's from a longer sequence called A Calendar, but it has to do with where I really grew up. It's we grew up in West Acton, Massachusetts, and my mother was the town nurse in the Actons, and one of the places that was dear to us was the old the bridge, et cetera. So this was a poem for July, by the rude bridge. Crazy wheel of days in the heat, the revolution spaced to summer's insistence, that sweat, the dust, time earlier they must have walked, run all the way from Lexington to Concord by the rude bridge that arched the flood, by that enfolding small river wanders along by grasses marged by thoughtless stones. Mm. I love that river by that bridge. Emerson has a great house there, as they say.
He does indeed.
Yeah. The place used to intimidate me, though, Concord. I was always very grateful that Captain Isaac Davis, got there from Acton and was unhappily forfeit. He was the first person to be killed, but it sort of joined Acton into the general action.
What was the intimidating part, the poetry or the battle?
No, the town. Concord was a very, very different town than Acton, Acton was a classic small farming town when I grew up there in the 30s. And the Concord had that sort of in some ways charming, but that old echo of authority, tradition, great literary figures.
Mm.
And it was a big league, no question. Yeah, it still is in a curious way.
I'd like you to read us some more.
Okay. The best way to choose is to open the book. A song. I wouldn't embarrass you ever. If there were not place or time for it, I would go elsewhere, remembering. I would sit in a flower, a face, not to embarrass you, would be unhappy quietly, would never make a noise. Simpler, you deal with me. I love both being sort of serious and not intentionally whimsical, but I had a charming aunt, my Aunt Bernice, whose wit and humor would always relieve the horrors of our then immediate situation. And I think wit is our, you know, extraordinary resource as so-called human beings.
Hmm.
And so I like anything that has that double of can see itself apart from the horrors of the dilemmas that it otherwise presumes to be facing.
Would you read the poem called Midnight on page 74?
Yeah, where is that? I'll get it. When the rain stops, I remember the opening of it. Yeah, when the rain stops, wait a minute, midnight. When the rain stops and the cat drops out of the tree to walk away, when the rain stops, when the others come home, when the phone stops, the drip of water, the potential of a caller any Sunday afternoon. It's almost a study in rhythms. I love that repetitive stops, when the rain stops, when the rain stops, the phone stops. That it's a cadence that I wanted, not didactically, but just played with, you know.
Hmm.
I love that sense of when will we go to the movies, et cetera.
When will we be there, Daddy?
When will we be there? The back seat syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. A week from Thursday was always my answer.
Yeah, next, soon.
Talk a little bit about, you said a lot about wit and rhythm and playfulness and short lines already, but how did you come to tune in on this voice in your own head, in your own life, in your own childhood, in your own ambition?
I never had a remarkable ambition to be a poet. Simply that poets in West Acton were not a valued commodity or presence. I remember that charming line of Allen Ginsberg's in preface to his father's poems, something like, "Few lyres sounded in the streets of Newark on the date of his father's birth." But anyhow, the poetry, our whole family had variously to do with it. My sister, dear sister Helen, 4 years older, my only sibling, she, for example, had been a classic and classy adolescent poet and won prizes and wrote a poem for the Lindbergh's baby's death, and Robert P. Tristram Coffin had given her, probably sibling rivalry as much as anything that got me started. Mm. And my Aunt Bernice wrote classic poetry for the Boston Globe, or Herald, I think it was. And I remember her last act on earth was a poem for George Washington's birthday that was published in the Sarasota Journal the next, you know, that weekend after her death. So there was, and my grandmother could recite, you know, Hiawatha and Evangeline, so it was an old-fashioned sense of presence and authority.
You say there wasn't a lot of poetry in West Acton when you were a kid, but you were also in Cambridge in the 40s and 50s, and
there was a lot of poetry,
all kinds of poetry, yeah, including contemporaries like Donald Hall and Richard Wilbur, who's probably a little older than you, and then Allen Ginsberg, and then the world.
I think of William Carlos Williams, the phrase, how to get said what must be said. It's one found in poetry, not just an accommodation, but an occasion and a permission that let one say how it felt. I think of Bob Dylan's phrase, "How does it feel to be on your own?" Remarkably little in the 40s seemed to tell one very clearly how it feels. There was a curious discretion, or it seems so, especially in Harvard. It wasn't that people were good people or bad people. It just no one was really talking much about. And I remember when I did finally get to the so-called war area, asking my terrific lieutenant, what's it like? He said, stick around, you'll find out. And there was nothing. I remember going to war, literally, with a copy of Pound's draft of 30 cantos and Yeats's last poems, late poems, that edition. But it located feelings for me in ways that I was very moved by. But I didn't think to be a poet. For many reasons, I didn't think I was able to be. But I began by writing prose, short stories particularly, and labored away at the classic novel. My good friends at Harvard were really Jack Hawks, for example, and Kenneth Koch, I happily knew. But even more to the point,
Norman Mailer on your
scope. He was in the class. He was a good friend of Mitch Goodman's, whom I knew, Denise Levertov's husband-to-be. I knew Donald Hall a little, but he came in after, say, in that curious break when the war has ended and people are returning, and that was when I was falling apart, really.
But what did you mean by falling apart?
I'd gone as an ambulance driver to Burma. And so I was the 44, 45 in that situation of a year. And then came back to Cambridge, where my family was then living, my mother on Spark Street. And I remember arriving home on Thanksgiving Day, and it was had that lovely sort of settled quiet. And it was so incongruous after the time in Burma, after the extraordinary disjunct and horrors of that particular war. There was nowhere really to place it. So within a year, I was married. Within a little more than that, we had our first son, and I'd fallen out of college pretty much, and never did get my degree there. I just couldn't take it very seriously. Sorry about that.
In the William Carlos Williams terms, I mean, how to get said what must be said. What did you? Was there a way to say what it was in your head that must be said?
Well, for example, I think one gets a feel of it in Allen Ginsberg, certainly in Denise, Paul Blackburn, Ed Dorn, I mean, Robert Duncan, that it was almost in some ways like the Emperor's New Clothes, the return to status quo after the end of the war was fairly terrifying. There was this kind of bubble of classic liberal expectations, but by 1950, it had all flattened out again, I think, and rather terrifying. The draft has been reinstituted and so on and so forth, so that it's interesting to me that just at that time, the post-war sort of information is basically existentialism and the dilemmas of how one is a person in the common world, or not, you know, what do you do for a living, but what does it mean to be human? And the sense of an anterior reality somehow permitting ours to survive, whether it be religious or otherwise. You can't throw it in the river anymore. It's not just political correctness. It's utterly impractical that there's nobody here but us chickens from that time forward, it seems to me.
What shaped this voice of yours, which is... I mean, I'm not the one to characterize it, but it's very open, it's very familiar, it is very much drawn from, as well as being enormously different from the commonplace, but it is a very kind of Americanese conversational inviting. Not that it yields
nice.
Well, I mean, no, why shouldn't I? Not that it yields all its fruit, you know, on the first reading, but...
Well, again, it's in some ways the honor of West Acton. I was, in some old-fashioned way, hoping to maintain simply that the difference in the rhetorical base, let's say, between the the American English is spoken in Harvard Square or Harvard or whatever, it wasn't the language that I felt commonly at home with. It wasn't the way I'd learned to speak. Or, I mean, I'd gone, began school in the act in West Acton in a classic old-fashioned school with two grades in a room where everybody knew everyone else. Mm-hmm. And it was very down home for me. It was very useful to me as a kid lacking a father to have that intimacy. And so I felt at ease in that. I felt an ease that was both practical and necessary as a writer to have. I found that, for example, Jack Kerouac was a friend from those years a little later. And that's what I loved in his work, not comfortableness, but that absolute ease and confidence. Allen Ginsberg always emphasized that Jack's great literary discovery was that one could write the same way one spoke, could use the same cadence and rhetorical diction, that pattern of that kind. I wasn't trying to speak commonly in the sense that I down, or, you know, to get down to a level that I presumed was, quote, common. But this was my language, and I was not about to yield it. And also the 40s, if one thinks of it, was a time when a heightened rhetoric was very commonly the case. There was a poetic language, and there was a language of usual speech.
Who defined the elevated rhetoric of the period?
Unwittingly, I guess Lowell to some extent in early books like Lord Wherry's Castle. The dependence upon English models certainly did. Auden, for example, it was simply not a cadence or a habit that was quite ours. Many of my own contemporaries were using it. The war between the anthologies, the Hall, Pack, and Simpson anthology on the one hand and the Donald Allen's New American Poetry on the other, that really defined the difference. To this day, it's still there in part in writers like Anthony Hecht or Mark Strand. Then one sees it shift and meld in a writer like Adrian Rich, for example, or in Lowell himself, the later poems particularly.
Robert Creeley is our guest. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. A poet of loneliness, as we said, but also the most social of poets, and a very connected, friendly poet, and an eminent American writer for well more than 50 years. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Robert Creeley connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Jane is on the line.
Good morning, Mr. Creeley. I was a student of yours in Buffalo about 30 years ago.
Thanks.
You were a fine teacher.
God bless you, my friend.
Well, I came to you having had a lot of, coming out of an English background with a lot of very traditional poetry in my head, and you turned me on my head. And I found later, as I think back on it, the way you used language and addressed language taught me to help my students see what poetry was about.
What do you think? I mean, I know that we're momently going to have to deal with that question. What is poetry about?
I want to first hear how he turned you on your head, Gene. Jane,
well,
sorry.
I came with a lot of preconceived notions about poetry.
Yeah.
And Mr. Creeley just very politely and gently kicked a lot of them in his wastebasket.
For example? Who are the false gods you brought into class?
Oh, dear. You're asking an old woman a hard question.
I'm older than you are.
Not much. I was the oldest one in that class, as a matter of fact. I was about 32 or 3 at the time.
The old days, right?
Yeah. I was called a retread. I think the whole notion of strict meter and rhyme, and particularly rhyming and fancy language as opposed to real language.
There was, I remember, Jane, I remember well indeed, not from you particularly, but the sense that poetry is for elevated thoughts and feelings, and that
yes,
you know, that it's special, and one can't use it in You have to be careful about what you say in a poem.
Well, I mean, you can't shock the native.
No, never.
And but you spoke in a language that was plain, that was accessible.
One thing I love, Jane, about is that I get occasionally people say, you know, you make poetry seem so easy. The way you write is a curious reassurance that anybody can do that. It's not, but they don't mean that you're therefore I'm useless, but they mean that I don't somehow make them feel inferior or unable.
No, you never talk down to anybody.
Yeah,
I was very interested that you at that time wore an eye patch.
Yeah, I gave that up after a few years.
Did you really?
Yeah, it got to be a nuisance. It was something, again, to where did I, you know, I used to smoke a lot in those days, and where did I put the cigarette lighter or ran out? The eye patch became just another thing to be located. So I began to recognize that people weren't really worried one way or the other.
That's right. You weren't wearing the patch, and you told us why.
Yeah.
Was it an important? Did you or Sammy Davis Jr. give up the eye patch first?
I think I did.
Oh, he did.
I did.
And
yeah.
What was the meaning of having it on and having it off? What was the meaning? I mean, to get to the beginning of losing your eye as an infant.
I remember it vividly. I think. I remember my mother being a nurse. We would occasionally go to the Concord to the hospital, I sometimes go with her, and she'd say, either sit in the car or come into the waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular day I did, and this particular day she said, "Now, Bob, I'd like you to come into this." And so I was led through this series of transitional stages into suddenly I was in an operating room, and lo and behold, my left eye was being removed. And I never quite got over that, not in the sense, but I felt a lot of anger. Hey, you know, come on, you guys, why didn't you tell me?
But you explained the reason for not wearing the patch having something to do with what you'd seen, I thought, in France.
Well, it was basically, I know that, for example, traveling abroad, there were so many people so variously physically changed, mutilated literally by the war, that a missing eye or a missing hand or a missing leg or a missing that, or it was commonplace. When I came back first, I was returning to college. The patch had a certain dash, you know, and emphasized that I had, you know, taken part in the great contest. So that was kind of okay. But then it got to be a nuisance, so I just gave it up altogether.
Jane, sum up what he taught you about poetry.
This is not a test, yeah?
Thank you.
You passed with honors.
What did he tell me about poetry? To read it, to love it, to pay attention to it, and to try and share that with other people.
Sounds
which
good.
I did in teaching high school.
Absolutely.
And it was very interesting. I taught for a few years in Tehran at the American school, and my students came from all sorts of backgrounds, from the pre-literate to the quite literate. And I found that your poems were things that everybody could read, not always getting the same things out of them, but they were accessible.
What's your favorite Robert Creeley? And maybe we'll ask him after the break to read it, Jane.
Oh, Lord. I don't have my copy here.
All right.
I'm sorry.
We'll pick our own. But, Jane,
Thank you, Jane.
It's a wonderful thing for a teacher to hear from a faithful student.
As good as it gets, Jane. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255. Rick is calling from Petersham, Massachusetts.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Welcome, Rick. Good.
Very good. Mr. Creeley, I have a question for you. You're obviously associated with the Black Mountain School. But I'd like to know what you feel your relationship is to the language school of poetry, because they seem to reference you quite a bit.
Well, Bob Grenier is a really old friend. I first met him physically. One of our then young daughters went out and said, "There's a body on the porch." We were living in Albuquerque, and it turned out that Bob Grenier had come in the night and was sleeping in a great mummy, you know, sleeping bag literally on the porch. We'd been in touch before, but I really like him immensely. And
he's the language school.
He's the person who says I hate speech, which is he took all the pieties, let's say, of my generation's concerns, and not so much attack them, but just turn them around, and was fascinated by text, by what words are saying as a written textual fact of things. She was fascinated by syntax, and but not didactically, but practically. That's where we always meet. And he had picked up on poems of mine where that is certainly partly the base. We both shared a great love for poets, say Louis Zukofsky, or, you know.
What defined the Black Mountain School?
It's a curious. What defined it was literally the publication of the New American Poetry, and Donald Allen's decision to group the writers. I remember Charles Olson was quite hostile to that. I thought that that was a bad idea. He said, if you do that, you'll have a divide and conquer situation. Hmm. So, but Don thought it would be simpler to gain a both readers and critical response if he gave them these hooks. So there's the New York School, there's the San Francisco, you know, Renaissance School, there's the, anyhow, there's the Black Mountain Group. That's how we happened to, and I suppose the loose designation is writers who variously had to do with the Black Mountain Review, which was the journal but
the real pleasure of those schools must be sort of outliving all of the boundaries and the borders. Yeah. Robert Creeley is our guest. We're going to ask him to read some more after the break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by CSC Consulting, helping clients achieve business results through innovative consulting and systems integration solutions. And by Fair Market, providing e-commerce leaders with the power of online auctions and now hiring across all functions at www.fairmarket.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection with the American poet Robert Creeley. The man and his work both incline toward collaboration. Here is the singer Sheila Jordan singing, it's really the first line of a poem, Nowhere One, to music by Steve Swallow. Day too. Steve Swallow wrote the music, the guitar player. Also, I'm happy to say my Yale classmate. He's one of many people who said you've got to get into Robert Creeley.
He's terrific, Steve.
How did the collaboration come about? And how do collaborations come about?
I mean, the most obvious occasion is being neighbors or having some fact of life together. That really is the basis of almost every collaboration I've done.
It started as a friendship?
Yeah. For example, Steve and I met in Bolinas, California, when he was living out there. He was not on the road. He was working as a bass player for groups coming through. And he was trying, really, to stay home. His marriage, you know, expectedly was being stretched by his traveling so much. And his wife was working as a classic decisive nurse in Point Reyes, much involved with home births and stuff, and so he lived just up the street from where I was, and our daughter Sarah sat, his terrific daughter, and we talked a bit, but we were shy, you know. We had a mutual friend, another dear poet, Eber Beauregard, and so we talked a bit, but we never really connected in some active way. And then a few years later, almost 10 years later, in fact, I had suddenly a letter from him asking if I would be agreeable to his using poems of mine as basis for this music he thought to do. He has a grant. And then he said this was recorded in one take. They did this, went in and worked. It has terrific people. Steve Kuhn's on piano, for example. And Sheila Jordan, I think, is wonderful. She's Renee Duke Jordan, she was married to for some real time. She comes out of the kind of... she went to Detroit, Cass Tech, I believe. Anyhow, she's a wonderful, extremely terrific singer.
What connections do you make with musicians in general? Well, and to be particular, I mean, to the post-war music sound, which was as important as the post-war poetry sound, maybe more.
One of the... Well, when I was then, in college, like they say, my friends were basically musicians. I think of Buddy Berlin, Ray Snooter is still playing in England. I'm trying to recall a terrific trumpet player who was there then. I remember when he came to Boston to go to school, Downbeat said someone, Joe Leach. I sadly caused him to be kicked out of Harvard, he didn't seem to mind all that much, but Joe Guy was here in the city. I was thinking of Dick Twardzik, for example. Herb Pomeroy's sort of terrific big band of juvenile delinquents.
Still thrives?
Yeah. I found that I was getting more from jazz in terms of how things might go together than I could really get it from, say, usual poetry. And this is where I first heard Charlie Parker and then Miles Davis. I said, I remember sharing a room on Tremont Street just off Huntington Avenue with a fellow named Joe Lacone, who was going to conservatory. And he was saying, if I could just learn bass, I played the violin. If I could just learn bass.
If you could just learn
bass.
Yeah,
I could play in their band. And we used to argue endlessly on whether chasing the bird was he thought, that's not real. You can't do that. You can't play two songs and say it's a song, one song. It's Miles Davis and Charlie Parker. I said, no, come on, you can do that. Anyhow, it was a wonderful time, and the freshness and the Perry Brothers and Club Savoy and the hi-hat, all of that stuff. Someone recently sent me a terrific recording, a CD of, Jackie Byard is the house pianist at the hi-hat. Well, it was a wonderful, wonderful day.
They were indeed. You are also a collaborator and still are with painters.
Right.
How does that work?
Well, I get painting. I mean, but I love to see the world as others see it. The classic line of Robert, God gives us the gift to see the world as others see us in the world, but see a world that's not simply my own habits. And it's particularly terrific with painters, just that their ways of seeing the world as the case is such a freshening of the usual conceptual terms of language. I mean, it's not saying look at this, look at that. It's much more than presenting. Even I'm fascinated, therefore, by what they come up with, and how they take it as actual. It's not just a picture of the world, but something in the world. Thus, and I've been at that in various ways ever since the time.
How do you know you're getting it?
They tell me. Yeah.
A measure of confidence to expect to get it in another medium, doesn't it? Even in your own.
Yeah, I mean, sort of. You have to be the idiot savant. You can't. You have to avoid explanation or description. I learned that early, that it was no good saying I see in this painting this, this, and this. I had recently the terrific pleasure of working. I was asked to do a poem for Susan Rothenberg's show that's presently up at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And she lives in New Mexico, et cetera, with her terrific husband, Bruce Nauman. But the point is, I wrote a poem using 19 of the images of 19 paintings she used to have in the show. And, I mean, I looked at them and wrote using the kind of tacit sequence. But the point is, I then sent it to her. A couple of days went by, and I thought, oh, my God, she probably doesn't like it. And then suddenly the phone rings one afternoon, and she said, how did you know? And I said, what do you mean? She said, how did you know all these things about me? And I said, she uses this lovely phrase, we don't even know each other that well. And I said, it's your paintings, Susan. I mean, partly the point of them, to get to people, not to tell them what you want them to know, but to make it evident to you, to them, where you feel the world is. And so anyhow, that was wonderful. That's the kind of reassurance that one couldn't, you know, otherwise get ever. And then I was thinking a very dear book recently was with Elsa Dorfman, En Famille, which for, I've known Ellie for years, and we were remembering coming in about the time when she had this tender agency for poets like myself called the Patterson Society, and variously, you know,
set up in New Jersey?
No, this was just down the road in Cambridge.
Patterson named for New Jersey?
Yes, for Williams.
Indeed.
Great, terrific work. And so she got readings for Olson and Duncan and Robert Bly and Leroy Then Jones and all the gang, Paul Blackburn, so on. So working, and she one time told me that she liked to have it. She came to photography because she felt at times awkward and so-called, so she liked to have something to do. And she's become, you know, she's this great, truly great photographer. And this summer we had chance to do this collaboration, which was wonderful. She gave me choice of these extraordinary large Polaroid portraits she does, and I was able to make a sequence of my own determination and then muse on family. I see we happily hit the news this morning. The definition of family is, I gather, to go to the Supreme Court.
Well, there are families who have Elsa re-record their reality every year, every 5 years.
Just to remind them?
Yeah, to tell them, maybe as Susan Rothenberg's paintings do. Read a poem out of that.
I'd like to.
Book with Elsa Dorfman on family.
Well, there's toward the end of the of my part in it, so to speak, there's a lovely cluster of families, four generations. On Sarah's 90th, it says, there's the grandmother sitting in the center, then the all girls, I think, all women. But anyhow, here's the poem is actually one long one, but here's the two verses that go with that particular image. We're here because there's nowhere else to go. We've come in faith, we learned, as with all else. Someone once told us, and so it is we know, no one is left outside such simple place. No one's too late. No one can be too soon. We comfort one another, making room. We dream of heaven as a climbing stair. We look at stars and wonder why and where. In one sense, that's probably as almost schwarmily or sentimentally even as simple a thing as I've ever managed to say, but I like it. Therefore, I do believe we're here because there's nowhere else to go. And we've come in faith, we learned as with all else. I mean, someone once told us, and so it is we know. I really think that's it. At my advanced age, I think that's the wisdom I've secured.
It's wonderful to have you with us. Robert Creeley, the phone is 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK. Ellen is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Ellen.
I'm from Gloucester. I had the pleasure of hearing Robert Creeley 2 years ago here when the celebration of Charles Olson's work. And what you just read makes me glad I stayed on the phone to ask a simple question. I want to know about Robert Frost and poets starting out when you did, whether his attempt to capture ordinary language influenced anybody or was even noticed by anybody. The poem that you just read makes me think of something of his when he says, I hear there's a new universe next door. Let's go.
That's Cummings.
Is that Cummings?
That's Cummings.
Ah.
Hey, there's a hell of a good universe next door.
Ah, okay. Let's go back to Frost, though.
Well,
maybe we should stick with Cummings for a moment.
That's okay, too.
I think there was always a tacit suspicion of Frost among my company. I remember Allen Ginsberg once showed me an anthology his father had given to him when Allen was still a kid. And for, among other things, it shows that, you know, puts Frost clearly in the cluster of turn of the century, 19th century poets. But Alan has penciled in a little Hitler mustache on Robert Frost. We were both saying, why did you do that? He said, I don't know, I just felt like doing it. It just, and you know, all these pictures of the poets, and this is the one that I got thrown out of a class in high school for mocking Robert Frost, and I remember the teacher afterward asking me to come see him and saying, you know, you've got to allow other people their own opinions. You can't. I was mocking him, actually. I think in part, again, that New England route made me suspicious of Robert Frost, not because he didn't come from West Acton, et cetera, but because he was trying, as you say, to capture. As I understand things, it was basically his neighbor's idiom, not his own. Hmm. So that there was a tacit, not a falseness, but it was more of an actor's adaptation of an accent or mode. I mean, again, I could obviously talk other ways, perhaps, but this is, I want to say what you see is what you get, or what you hear is what you get in what I'm doing. I want to work with the most common materials I can get, which is the way I would usually speak. Frost, the poet back of Frost, the one I really love, is Edwin Arlington Robinson, who was both very stylish, who, I remember it's, Ivor Winters says possibly, in his estimation, Eros Tyrannus is perhaps the greatest lyric in the language. Hmm. I mean, he's an incredible poet. And I also like, I'm partial to Maine poets. Later, Marston Hartley, both poet and painter, is terrific. Or like Emily Dickinson, if one wants a clarity of speech, that's to me it. I was on a plane recently, and the in-flight magazine had a collection of poems by Frost that he had written for Christmas issue. That is, as someone, anyhow, it started, and so one was being shown a spate of poems over maybe 10 or 15 years, and they were very disappointing, I thought. they weren't phony, but I mean, someone could do the same with my own work or with anyone's, but it was just, I never liked Robert Frost, let's put it that way. And I paradoxically, or actually still don't.
And you haven't softened a lot. Ellen, it's your turn.
I think with Frost, you never get what you see. It's very twisted, and it sounds simple. It sounds like hearing what you hear, but actually he's doing a lot of other things. He's a very dark poet. You're right, he's not a New Englander, but he's posturing as one. He comes from California.
Yeah.
And he had all sorts of things in mind. He's not, I love Robinson too. Yeah.
It isn't, I don't, it's just, he's so usurped the New England idiom. I mean, for example, when Olson was doing research on, aspects of New England, he found out that Frost had an extraordinary authority in all the library archives. That one somehow had to go through him to get permission to use things like the Magnolia historical records, and it just seemed absurd that he had become this artifact for our habits of speech in person.
Ellen, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Robert Creeley Connection. 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, John.
You can hear me.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I'm inspired to call in because I heard you, Chris, talking a few minutes ago about quoting Ginsberg about Kerouac, talking about confidence of utterance, confident voice. You mentioned that about half an hour ago.
Okay, well, let's say I did. Okay.
Well, here's the idea. I want to ask Creeley, because I'm a writer myself, and I listen to the way people speak and write.
Yeah.
And I think that confidence of utterance in this society, both among poets and among people right on the street,
yeah,
is declining visibly in front of us. I think the rhythmic, confident, gut-driven, feeling-driven lines of speech that used to be American seem to me to be fading out. You know, there seems to be a fog coming in and settling in people's vocal cords. They do not seem to utter from as far down in their guts as they used to. It pisses me off.
Well, I think there's an instance right there, but I mean, how many times a day do you hear, there you go, or don't go there? Yeah. We're being drowned in a way.
Have a nice day.
Well, that's the worst, maybe.
Well, since Creeley is a poet, I want to ask you what you think. Do you hear this too?
Yeah. I mean, I teach also, so that I sense it among the young. It isn't that they've lost heart, but it's as though there's a lot of quicksand, and there's also a sense of being judged or taken. There's a lot of sort of cosmetic surface that that qualifies in a way that it perhaps didn't, not so many years ago.
I think there's a kind of weight sitting on people's diaphragms, frankly. I think that people simply can't get their breath deep enough into their guts to talk from. And it just makes me feel lonely, honest to God. People are not talking from as far down inside themselves, it seems to me, as they used to.
Well, I think they're much more shaded or much more cautious. That I do think's true. I mean, as you're talking, I love your voice is attractive. You've got a classic, you live here, so to speak. That's always a pleasure.
I'm talking from the place in my gut where it hurts not to meet as much of this as I used to hear.
Yeah. No, I can understand that.
What can be done about it?
Well, we can't, so to speak, legislate or demand. We can walk away or get bored. I mean, and we don't have to pay attention to that, which frankly doesn't interest us. So that's one obvious way. There is a whole other poetry I'm going to say whether one's thinking of hip hop or poetry slams or physical poetry where not just, deliverance or entertainment in some showbiz sense is truly it. I think we're into a decorous time again in poetry. I'm sure of that we're in, not so much to entertainment, but to discreet and well-formed phrasings, things of that sort, which would be disappointing to you as to me.
I wanted to ask you, strictly because there's so much, as we say, commonplace phrasing in your work. We started out with that poem, I Know a Man. Drive, he said, for Christ's sake, look out where you're going.
Yeah.
I mean, very familiar sort of...
Yeah.
Handled phrases, and yet they have a kind of, and they're coming somewhere, as John says, from a gut. How do you sort out between these kind of TV cliches and sort of this kind of manufactured jargon that we also talk, and the good American commonplace?
I've never been successful with sort of trying to make to assay it or to trying to weigh it or value it in some literalizing way. But the a factor for me, for example, has been that all my life I've basically been an improvisational writer. That is, what I write is usually one shot. It's victim of that, not glibness, but that quickness at times. But most often, if it doesn't seem to work, I throw it away or I just don't keep it. I can't redo it. So again, I found a great correspondence with friends who are musicians who would, listen to music endlessly and practice play, but when they were working, that was it. They didn't get a second chance. And so that's the way I felt, and also with Kerouac writing that way. Or Coleridge. I was dazzled to realize that Coleridge... was quoting and dictating the Literaria Biographia. That was mind-blowing.
Can we close with, would you let me read one of my favorites, an early poem of your selected poems, a poem called Old Song?
Yes.
Take off your clothes, love, and come to me. Soon will the sun be breaking over yon sea, and all of our hairs be white, love, for aught we do, and all our nights be one, love, for all we knew. Robert Creeley, thank you enormously for joining us on The Connection. We hope you'll do it again. Robert Creeley of Selected Poems, Collected Poems, many, many poems over the years. We're going out with Robert Creeley poem Midnight with the music of Steve Swallow. Thanks for help today from James Isaacs, Walter Dixon, and George Hicks. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
When the rain potential of a
funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. And by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors of law, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients.
PRI, Public Radio International.